by for Wyoming Hooking and Hunting Outdoors with your host, True Kirby.
Hey, this is Luke Holmes.
I am Morgan Wallen.
I'm Riley Green.
I'm Travis Denning.
Hey, I'm Aaron Lewis.
Hey, it's Luke Bryan.
I'm Tim McGraw.
What's up? This is Ian Munsick.
Wyoming Hooking and Hunting Outdoors.
Every week, Janet from Wyoming Game and Fish Department joins us and brings in some special guests. And Janet, we talked a couple of weeks to John McCoy about doing a series of aquatic, you know, like topics and things that people may not know that happens. And this is our first show of this three-part series.
It is. All things aquatic habitat is really what we want to talk about. And the Wyoming Game and Fish Department has different divisions. So we have a wildlife division, and we all know we talk a lot about wildlife division. We have fish division, and within fish division, we have three little subdivision sort of things. We have our culture section, which is all of our hatcheries who, you know, raise the fish to stock out into our fisheries. We have our fisheries managers who are our biologists who are out doing a lot of the science on the ground on a daily basis and then come back in the winter and crunch those numbers and decide how to quote unquote manage the fisheries. And we have the aquatic habitat biologists who are kind of our boots on the ground, looking at how things look long term, right? Some of these other things are maybe a little bit quicker turnaround than some of the stuff that John gets to deal with in aquatic habitat. But he is here today to start a series of information on aquatic habitat projects that the Wyoming Game and Fish Department has going on here in the Casper region. And while the projects that we're talking about are just here around Casper, the things that he's talking about, for example, beaver dam analogs, go on across the state and actually across the country. And so it's really kind of neat to see how all of these things are connected.
John, how many projects will be ongoing at the same time around the Casper region? Because I know it's not just we're going to start this one and finish it. There, you'll start them and then kind of work on them as you can.
Yeah, no, that's you're spot on there. And all these projects take a decent amount of time to start, plan, get going, permit, and then construct. So it's kind of a process moving through the, you know, moving down the line of different tasks you have to accomplish to get something done on the ground. It's similar to like a lot of other, like, you know, if you're a developer, if you're building something, you know, there's planning, there's permitting, and then there's implementation, right? It's kind of goes through a three-stage process. So
the one thing John is forgetting is finding the funding. Like, we can't forget that. That is the big challenge for the Wyoming Game and Fish Department on a lot of these aquatic habitat projects because they are so long-term. And so we do often look for, you know, long-term grants and those sorts of things, which John spends a significant amount of time doing.
Yeah, no, Janet, that's right. You know, that's a part of my year. Typically, you know, we're putting in for funding in the winter months early on to get that money secure so we can start looking at hiring different, you know, design firms, engineers to put together plans for what we want to do. And then, then the planning stage, permitting, and then we go in and hire construction firms a lot of times too to build these projects that we're talking about. So, as you can imagine, it's a long process. So you want to kind of start projects offset so that you're always kind of working on getting something across the finish line each year. You know, that's kind of my goal. So currently we've got approximately, it's a big year. We've got maybe four projects that we're going to be looking at getting in here this year. Different intensities, you know, some of them are going to be big yellow equipment down in the river working. Others may be, you know, a little more, bit more light-handed doing some of the beaver dam analogs, going in there with hand crews and putting stuff together. It's something you definitely want to make sure you've got everything in concert so things happen at the right times and you're always making sure you're busy in the fall working on construction and, you know, planning and funding and everything in the winter and spring. So
will all of your projects just have to do with the water, or what about the areas around the water?
Yeah. So, well, the riparian areas, the areas directly adjacent to streams, you might call it a floodplain. Those are inherently tied in with the health of the water in streams and also in lakes and ponds. They're those like fringe areas where you get a lot of green grasses, you know, cottonwoods, a lot of other shrubs that need water. And those all play a pretty key role in the lives of wildlife and aquatic organisms, waterfowl, birds. It's, you know, out here in a dry landscape like Wyoming, the riparian areas really are what tie life together. You know, most species have some component of their life that's dependent on these little stream systems, river systems, and the vegetation and floodplains around them. So we'll focus on the whole thing. And yeah, specifically, you know, that takes us more up into the headwater areas a lot of times. We have terrestrial habitat biologists that do more upland habitat restoration. But where we kind of come together and work together up in these headwater areas, because a lot of times the line is pretty fuzzy on, you know, what's a low-lying depressional area that turns into a stream and what's upland. So we'll work together in a lot of those areas. And there's a lot of cool ways you can do work with like hands-on stuff, where you don't necessarily need heavy equipment. You can get a lot of work done for relatively cheap, you know, all things considered, compared to bigger river restoration.
So really you have a classification for the project's levels. You know, you may have those simple, you know, jobs that you can get done very quickly, and then you have the broader, larger type of projects. And I think today we're kind of going to focus a little bit on those lower end projects, to the lower level restoration type. John, let's highlight one of the lower level jobs that you guys may do.
Yeah. So, and you know, I'll preface it too. You know, a lot of these projects, they're less expensive, but you know, they still have great importance. I don't want to necessarily call them low level, but they are easier to complete. I'll certainly say that.
Yeah.
A lot of times your funding requirement is much lower and your permitting burden is a lot less. And yeah, like we said, you can get work done with just a crew of volunteers going out there and doing handwork. And yeah, the department, we've had a pretty good history, especially here in the Casper region, of doing some of these projects. One of them specifically occurs in a tributary of the North Platte River called Bolton Creek. Now, Bolton Creek spills into the North Platte River just upstream of Government Bridge, and it's long been identified as a source of a lot of fine sediment. I mean, if you've ever driven up 487 heading to Laramie, you'll notice that country is eroding. It's got a lot of dirt that's visible, you know. And because of that, when water hits it, a lot of that dirt ends up down in the creeks and then thus down into the North Platte River. And we've identified that to be detrimental to trout spawning. It also can lead to issues in the river with excess fine sediment, which can conversely lead to bank erosion in the river. You have a lot of small islands starting to form when that river can't transport that fine sediment out. It gets essentially, in a layman's terms, clogged up. And then you get weird places where water wants to push up against banks, and you can actually have land loss from landowners and a degradation of aquatic habitat in the river. So we've had a real incentive to get up in the tributaries and try and restore those streams to healthy forms that can support holding that soil in, holding that fine sediment up in the headwaters. But then we also get a great benefit for the critters that live up there, the mule deer, the elk, the antelope, the sage grouse, black-footed ferret live up in the, you know, Shirley Basin, right? So like there's a ton of wildlife that can all benefit from it as well. So it's a great area where we have decided to focus our efforts.
It's an ongoing project. So you'll go every year and kind of shore up an area that maybe is coming off to be a little worse than it was the year before?
That's for sure a component. You know, we've got, you know, probably a solid 15 years of projects just going in stream, probably more like 2025 on planning and watershed assessment. But we've been able to get quite a few restorations done along the river. So maintenance is always a big part of that. I'll go in and check up on some of these places we've done work, and if maintenance is needed, we'll go in and do it. But because it's such a long watershed, a lot of times another component is going and finding new areas. you know, that might be on public land. It might be on private property that has direct influence on public land. But we go in and we go and try and find areas that are not doing as well as they could be. A lot of times that's going out and finding new project sites as well as maintaining the old ones.
So when you're finding these new sites, what's the process to kind of get the work started?
Yeah, well, the first part is to just to identify it as a problem area. You know, there's different protocols you can run on a certain given reach of stream, and it can give you a number on its health. A lot of times the eye test works really well for this too. However, you know, we don't like to be super subjective. We like to put numbers on things, you know, to be scientific. And I mean, to make sure and ensure we're doing good work and on the ground, right? If we just went off of opinions, that wouldn't get us too far in the long run, right? So we like to put numbers on habitat and get an idea if it's healthy or not. And yeah, the places that highlight themselves will score worse, right? And then that then gives us the opportunity to say to like funders and, you know, even justifying work to our higher ups in the department, like, hey, this area is lacking. Here's what it's lacking and here's what it's impacting downstream. And then that then leads to, you know, projects getting a little bit of money from conservation organizations, pots of money that are set aside for conservation, that kind of thing. So that's kind of the initial step is, yeah, finding what needs done and then making sure that it's got enough benefit to justify our time going into it.
Once you find a place that needs work, how long does it take for you to identify the problem, come up with a plan, and then put the plan to work?
Yeah, it can be, you know, I would say, you know, a project that's moving as quick as you'd possibly hope for, you could probably get it done in a year. You know, you could identify a problem in the fall, put together your plan and your budget over the winter, right? You could, yeah, get your permitting and stuff done in the spring. And then, yeah, by the following fall, you could be on the ground doing work. And in a lot of these headwater small stream areas like Bolton Creek, we've been able to do that. And it's great because, you know, a lot of times these bigger projects can take a little bit longer to get done. So having these projects where it's a year turnaround, it's pretty encouraging because we can see a real benefit on the landscape in a hurry.
Once the work is completed, how quickly will you see a result that you're happy with?
Yeah. Well, with one particular technique, it's kind of applicable in most of the work we're doing. But one technique we use is called beaver dam analogs. And essentially what those are is we're going to mimic what you see in a beaver dam. You know, a lot of times beavers get a bad rap. They'll get around to irrigation infrastructure and they'll muddy things up, right? They'll clog up water and it'll flood. But in natural areas and stream areas, they also have a great impact in building resiliency. So they help expand where that water can go, and you end up with more green grass, more vegetation on the landscape, which is better for all stakeholders, right? Wildlife, as well as grazers and anyone out there who's using the landscape. So it's a good benefit. But with that, you know, implementing those techniques revolved around beaver dam analogs or translocating beavers, you can see an uplift of water out on the landscape right away. And anytime you're holding more water on the landscape, and we're not keeping it there, we're just slowing it down most times. But when you're allowing the animals and wildlife and fish and aquatic organisms to access that water more readily, you're going to have a great impact right away.
There are a lot of people that are like, oh, beavers, I hate beavers. I like the using nature and taking hints off of nature on, you know, I mean, you think of people that use calls for hunting, you know, they use what the wildlife do to enhance that. So it's kind of like the same process, just use nature as your research tool.
And honestly, that transitions really well into some of these low-tech aquatic restoration techniques we use, like the BDAs. We take hints from what we see in nature in a stable condition, in a healthy condition, and then we'll go out there and try and mimic it. We'll try and add something to the landscape that mimics what would naturally cause it to be good. And then we find that those solutions usually give us the best long-term result, because it's kind of the direction that the stream's wanting to head, but maybe it's having some trouble getting there. It's not getting there in the time frame that us as humans like to see, you know.
Right.
We like to see quick results overnight. You know, nature recovers, but it takes some time sometimes. Trees take a long time to grow back, you know. Vegetation can be cagey with coming back as well. I mean, grasses and forb communities.
It sure is fascinating, the hard work that goes into all these projects.
For sure. I mean, anytime there's water involved, you know, you've got a public resource there that impacts others downstream. So to ensure that anything happens and water doesn't negatively impact someone, say, downstream from you, unfortunately, there has to be that permitting component. And that's kind of the world that we play in. And but we set good projects up that have positive impacts on those around us. You know, we want to, in our minds, what's good for wildlife, it's good for everybody, right? It's an easy sell, because a lot of times the things that are good for wildlife will actually benefit, say, someone, a rancher out on the landscape, or a, you know, a water rights holder downstream, because it's going to give them more water in the long run, right? We're trying to hold on to that water longer, right, and release it later into the season and make it available for more folks.
John, I know that you rely a lot on volunteers to get these projects done. What's the best way for people to keep up to date and find out which projects do need help?
Well, you know, a good place to start would be calling into your regional office. You know, if you're in Casper here, you can always call in, and you know, whoever fields the call, might be Brian, maybe Janet, but they do a good job of diverting those folks who are wanting to help out to the habitat biologists and fish biologists who are out doing this conservation work, right? So it's always good. You know, you kind of keep a list of names that have signed up in the back of your head for a project that's coming up, and maybe you call on some of those names, you know, when you've got something happening where you need some bodies to help you, you know, put some beaver dam analogs in or do some other projects that require some lifting, planting, riparian vegetation that can be, you know, labor intensive. And it's always great to have folks come and help for that. And that's the fun stuff too, right? That's where you get your hands dirty. You know, you're out working all day, and then at the end of the day, you look at what you've done and you can say, wow, like, this is an improvement on, you know, what it was. And it's a good feeling.
Very cool. Well, lots of projects going on at all times, and I can't wait till next week, John. We'll get into another project that you guys have been working on. Guys, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Drew.
Yep, thank you.
You got it. All right, coming up, we are going to recap the weekend at Pathfinder for the Wyoming Walleye Stampede, weekend number 3. It's coming up.
It's Wyoming Hooking and Hunting Outdoors.
Here we are, Pathfinder, actually at Sloan's at Alcova, where we do our award ceremony after the Wyoming Walleye Stampede with Brian and Mitch. And guys, it was a tough one to really start. We heard a lot of good reports through the week. And Brian, I know it's fishing, not catching, but boy, I sure thought you were going to catch a lot more than had this weekend.
You know, there wasn't a problem with catching. It was a problem with catching the quality fish, because we heard a lot of stories throughout the week that guys have caught their personal best, you know, 30, 30 and a half, 32 inch fish. And so, you know, kind of looking at and listening to the reports that we were getting, we thought, you know, this could be one of those events. And we've had an event here before. I think it was 40 some pounds on day one. That didn't happen on this tournament, but there were still some really good quality fish caught.
And Mitch, I know that there were some, you know, big ones caught, but not a lot of big ones that we thought. I think 32 and a quarter on day two was the biggest fish for both days.
Yeah, 32 and a quarter was the biggest. I think yesterday we had three fish over 23 was all, or four fish, and today was two or three. It was, I mean, and as Brian said, you know, the week leading up to this, you know, we sat on Friday night going, we're gonna have 25, 30 pounds on day one. Everyone's catching big fish. And we got Saturday and everyone went, I don't know what's going on the last 2 days, but the big fish just aren't here.
You know, in a situation like that, I would say that someone that couldn't make it up to pre-fish is, you know, just in the same boat as someone that pre-fished for the whole week.
Well, you know, this is a reservoir system. You know, we're on the North Platte system, and, you know, we've got Glendo, we've got Pathfinder, Alcova, and Seminole all have great walleyes in them. But this reservoir system is a lot different than a natural lake fishes. And so we're at 5,900 feet elevation Water's a little bit colder. I mean, we're seeing water temperatures in the low 70s down at Glendo. I think I saw 65 today and 62 this morning. So not only are we battling some lower temperatures, but they're also dropping the reservoir. So this reservoir is probably dropping 3 inches, 4 inches a day at this point. And so that's definitely affecting how these fish are responding to the lake itself.
Yeah, and just overnight, we saw even a rainstorm yesterday, but there, it was 6 inches different than it was yesterday here.
Well, that, and you know, you and I were in the boat measuring fish, and it seemed like everywhere we stopped, we just looked down in the water, and there was just pods and pods of little minnows, just bait. And so, you know, you kind of ask yourself, if there's that much bait in this reservoir, you know, why would they eat my plastic or my crankbait or my worm harness or whatever it is that you're throwing. So I think the guys really did a good job of dissecting this lake and actually finding some big fish. It was great.
So Mitch, this was number three, tournament number three of the circuit, means the championship now in Poison. And, you know, we've seen three new winners, really. I mean, no real repeats over the last couple of years anyway.
Yeah, I don't think we've had a repeat in the last several years, and this one, you know, husband and wife team that had fished with us for a while, big fish rule. They had a 32 and a quarter that did it for them, and the second place team I think had a 30 and a half, and third place had a 28. Those were the three biggest fish we saw all weekend, and this event I think was really well put together weather wise. The Sloan's was great down here. We do a barbecue on Saturday night to kind of just cap off our qualifying season and leading into the championship, the big one that everybody wants to get to.
Which, and that'll be in Poison, and it'll be a couple of weeks probably before you guys can crunch the numbers, because you take the top 60 of everyone that's fished in all three circuits, right?
Yeah, and this is kind of we wanted to make this more of a prestigious event. We didn't want people to just be able to buy their way in, or, you know, give them a whole bunch of ways to qualify. These are guys that have fished all three events. Most of them fished with the same partner. Some have had some subs. But this championship is prestigious enough that, you know, we have about $12,000 of added money. So this championship for a 60-team championship is going to pay out like 120 or 140 boat field. So I think first place we paid $12,000 or $15,000 last year for first place. So guys are really fighting to get into this. You know, they're like, what do I need to do? Like, how do I need to finish? You know, boy, if I just would have finished a little bit better, if I would have caught one more fish at that tournament, I would have gained a few more points. Guys are, you know, it's not a gimme. You know, we've got guys that have fished 17 years worth of tournaments that are on the cusp of not qualifying for the championship because it just didn't fish the way they wanted it to fish this year. And we've got some new teams that, you know, dug it out, you know, like today with Lori and Brian. They didn't have a fish before noon, I think. You know, then they popped a 32-incher. Then they got a little bit of hope. They're like, man, we caught this big one on a worm harness. Let's go try this other area and try worm harnesses back there. And I think within an hour, they came back with five more fish to add to the pot, you know. So these teams are grinding it out, and it's going to be at Poison Reservoir. Poison in the later part of the summer generally fishes really good. It could be a big fish bite. And guys can catch fish really with just about any presentation out there.
You know, and Mitch, like Brian was saying, it just takes one fish. That really changed the game for the winners, Lori today, and then yesterday, the first place with Chuck and Jeremiah. You know, I mean, that's just something that you get to the championship. It's really, nobody's a favorite, I wouldn't say.
Yeah, and I think that's what's nice about the championship events that we do, the reservoirs that we're going to. You know, Glendo's great. Glendo fish is really good in the spring. We love May and June at Glendo. And then you get to that third and fourth one, and it's a little different. It's a little bit more of a grind, and it's for the serious people, too. It's the guys that really, you know, I think the 97 teams, we had 89 of them fished all three of our events. Wasn't 2-3 years ago. We were, you know, we had maybe 70 teams. We were going down 70 spots to try and fill a 60-team field. And I think, as Brian said, some of these guys that are veterans, so to speak, they're 20 places out of the top 60. So I think that Poison event's going to be very similar to this. I think the quality of fish there are a little bit better, big fish-wise, probably equal. Mm-hmm. But what we saw last year was a lot of 18- to 20-inch fish that hopefully grew up a little bit more and one or two big fish there will be very similar to this reservoir.
You know, and the difference between this year and last year is we're flip-flopping. So we were at Boisen and had the championship here at Pathfinder. This year at Pathfinder, then Boisen. Like, what are going to be the ideas going into that? Because, you know, July to August, two different, you know, fisheries.
Well, one of the things that tends to happen that I've noticed at Boisen is that it has a really big, like, mayfly hatch or just a bug hatch in general. It's got a lot more weeds than Pathfinder. Pathfinder is basically a sandy and rocky. So that's what you see here. High elevation desert lake is what we've got here. But you get over to Boisen, it's right at the base of the Wind Rivers, so it's a beautiful sight. But it's got a lot of different terrain. It's got a lot of rocks, you know, the down by the dam, there's riprap. On the south end, there's weeds, creek channels, river channels that come in there. And the bug bite tends to, I mean, the bugs in general are thick. And so I think if that bug hatch is going on, the fish are going to respond differently. You know, when those bugs are hatching on the bottom of the reservoir, a lot of times you find those fish halfway through the water column as they're coming to the surface. So it just fishes differently. It tends to be pretty wormy, in my opinion, because when the bug bites good, the worm bites good. But we've seen guys pitching jigging wraps. We've seen guys pulling cranks. Just about anything you could possibly think of during that tournament. Because there are fish all over that lake. Just depends on how they're responding to the forage in the area that they're at.
How do you choose the 60 teams? Is it points through the season, or how is it that you figure that out?
Yeah, so we do three qualifying events. We do our first two at Glendale, and typically our third one we try to decide between Seminole, Pathfinder, Boisen. Water level, snowpack, you know, really rely on that probably first and foremost for us, just kind of an outlook that we try to guess. And then just what the fisheries look like. So we do those first three events, and we give points based on placings for each event. And then we go down that point standings for the top 60 teams, and we only take the top. You have to fish all three tournaments to be able to qualify. So there's tournaments where if you win one, you automatically qualify. You know, we want guys to commit to the season. We want guys to be able to enjoy the camaraderie and you know, get to fish a season together. And we allow them to mix match partners. But we want them to fish all three events to be able to get to that fourth one. As Brian said, it's pretty prestigious. We wanted it to be something that had a little more value and a little desire to get to.
Well, and that kind of goes back to those that do fish every tournament. Maybe they don't do so well, but they fish every tournament and have a pretty good chance.
Yeah, well, I mean, again, each one of these reservoirs fishes differently at different times of the year. There are some guys that are just really good at live bait fishing. There's other guys that just can't wait for the reservoir that comes up where they can pull crankbaits and they're going to dial in and cover a lot of water. And there's guys that are just good at pulling worms and building worm harnesses and deciding what colors work and whether you pull a crawler or you pull a leech or whatever the case is. But everybody has their finesse. And the angler that can dissect and be diversified across all levels and recognize that, hey, today's a crankbait, today's a worm bite, tomorrow's a jig and a minnow bite. Those are the anglers that we typically see in that top 20 on a consistent basis because they're just very well versed and they just figure it out.
It's awesome. And if you've never been into one of these tournaments or you've never even really looked at them, it's fun to really just look back and kind of see how it runs because it really is exciting. And all the anglers, you know, what do we have out here, like 48 or 60 teams that were still sticking around at the awards because they love to support everybody else. And that's kind of cool about what this has built over 16 years is more of a family environment than, you know, just a tournament.
Yeah, that's what we were kind of going for from the start. We wanted something that was, you know, we've said it before, you know, a tournament for the fishermen, by the fishermen. You know, our experience in the past, I think we didn't want it to go to a national level by any means. We wanted to keep it, you know, that camaraderie. And as you saw it here, you said 40 to 60 people here. We had grandparents, moms, dads, husbands, wives, pregnant wives. Yeah. You know, we've got a mix of everybody that likes to come and be a part of it. At the end of the day, we have people standing on the shore that sit there and watch the weigh-ins and kind of watch the process, you know. So it's exactly what we wanted.
Well, and, you know, we've got great sponsors that, you know, throw in money for additional sponsorships for different divisions. We got the family division, a poor boys division. You know, those types of divisions really kind of opened this up to all levels of anglers. And there was a time that, you know, the circuit in Wyoming was the pro team circuit. And it really kind of rubbed us wrong that, you know, like we're advertising this as a pro team circuit because it alienates the guys that are like, I'm not a pro. I'm just fishing with my kid. And so that's what it's become. It's become, hey, let's, like we're putting in for elk tags, you know, let's put in for the season. We're going to go ahead and fish all the events. We're going to look forward to it. We're going to pre-fish X number of days. We're going to bring our wives. We're going to make it a camping trip. You know, we're going to pack lunches or we're going to pack barbecue. And, you know, they make it an event, you know, just like you would if you drew elk tags. And so we don't want this to be a pro team event. We would certainly encourage anybody that wants to come fish our events at whatever level you are, but it's pretty hard to compete against the locals. I mean, our anglers, I think hands down, are some of the most diversified anglers across the country, and their time on the water is as good as any pro team out there.
One of the fun parts is Mark and Curtis, you know, they won and they've been on that pro side of things and they'd rather come here. And, you know, from Colorado and Nebraska, and there's a guy that comes every year from Wisconsin to be part of this. So it really has kind of, outside of being a official national tournament, it's still a big series.
It's definitely a very regionally based. You know, we usually have teams from about seven states represented. And that's pretty exciting. I mean, we got people, you know, at some, like a lake like Pathfinder, if you live in Colorado Springs, you're looking at a 7 or 8 hour drive, you know, so there's a commitment there. And guys that are coming from the Dakotas and Nebraska and Utah, they got to put their time in and we appreciate it. And I think, you know, they all get to there. We had a handful of guys that had never fished this reservoir before, and they were really nervous about, you know, losing their lower unit because water levels were dropping. But at the end of it, they're like, man, this is a beautiful reservoir. I've never fished up here. Hard to figure out, but any reservoir system is.
You know, as we wrap up from Pathfinder, I know it was a great weekend because Sloan's did a great job, offer up the cabins, and Dave Elmer did the barbecue on Saturday night, which Mitch was talking about a little bit earlier. So there's a lot of people that pitch in that want to be part of this.
Well, and a huge thanks to Frank's Butcher Shop and Brenton Manufacturing for sponsoring the event. We had the burgers and brats last night were straight from Frank's Butcher Shop in Casper. If you haven't had their meat, I'm telling you, it's some of the best out there. They do online delivery, so now's your time to check it out. But we all enjoyed it and appreciate their support for this event.
Absolutely. Thanks so much, Brian and Mitch. In just minutes, we will chat with the winners of the event this week, Brian Locke and Lori Snodgrass. Coming up.
It's Wyoming Hooking and Hunting Outdoors.
It's Wyoming Hooking and Hunting Outdoors at Pathfinder, where we just wrapped up for the week. And Lori Snodgrass and Brian Locke, you guys really kind of had a tough day on day one. But Lori, day two, you guys were pretty stoked on what you caught the first fish.
It took us 4 hours into the day. We were pretty down on ourselves, really. But all of a sudden, there she was, and felt pretty good.
So, Brian, I know that you guys were kind of struggling. Not just you guys. Everybody was struggling. Catching those 15 inches, and really it was kind of a tough weekend. But then once you got that 32, was that pretty much game on? You knew that you could get out there and really change the game?
Yeah, it sure seemed like a person needed a good kicker fish to kind of send you up there a little way. So weeding through 16s probably wasn't going to do it. And we were just lucky enough to get a good one.
It's nice to be able to, you know, like, adapt on the move. Because it's tough. You kind of get into your, you know, this is our game plan. This is how we're going to do it. But you catch something like that, you really want to be like, okay, I need those kickers, right, Lori?
Yep. Pressure's on at that point. You finally get a good fish, and we've been there, done that, kind of gotten that fish, and then couldn't put anything together. And luckily, we went out and put a bag together.
So when you got back to the truck, were you like crunching numbers and like really just like, okay, we know we've got it, looking at yesterday's numbers, or were you like, we'll just play it as it comes?
Kind of wing it. We didn't know. I mean, we thought we did pretty well, but obviously this is a huge surprise to us.
Figured we'd climb the ladder, but not
yeah,
this.
Hoping for top 10. So,
yep.
Yeah, a first place finish is absolutely incredible.
Yep.
Lori, how long have you guys been fishing the Stampede?
Us together has been about 6-7 years. Brian fished with his dad and another partner in the other Wyoming circuit back in the day, but I think we've been doing it about 8 years, maybe.
So it's got to be pretty exciting then to see exactly, you know, going to the championship as a front runner.
Right. It's pretty awesome.
That's pretty cool, right?
There you go.
The winners, Brian Locke, Lori Snodgrass, taking home first place, but their sidekick, and well, my sidekick all weekend, we got to hang out with her son, Sawyer. How do you feel right now?
Really excited.
Yeah? What happened over the weekend that really excited you so much?
Them coming in and seeing that fish in the live well.
How big was it?
About one end to the other.
One end to the other, right. What was the total weight?
About 12 pounds.
You were pretty, 12 pounds, you were very excited, weren't you?
Yes.
You were. You were jumping up and down and just getting crazy and wild.
Yes.
Yeah. Pretty good time, wasn't it, though?
Yeah.
You got to have fish. You got to catch the first fish on the first day?
First day, but the second day was not that fun.
Oh, who won the first day?
Me.
Oh, you did now. Oh, did you now? Okay, fine. Don't give credit where credit's due, right?
Mm-hmm.
But we had a good time, and you're going home with the big win, right? Because mm-hmm. you get moral support on this one.
Yeah.
Congratulations again, Brian and Lori. Now, since you got the win and the big check, Sawyer wants McDonald's on the way home. That's all he talked about all weekend. But thanks again, and congratulations.
Thank you very much.
We appreciate you.
You guys are awesome. You do a lot of work.
Stick around, and if you've listened to this show long enough, you know that Noah Davis is one of the kids that has really grown up with walleye fishing in the Stampede. He actually competed this week. We'll chat with Noah in just minutes.
It's Wyoming Hooking and Hunting Outdoors.
All right, one more time from Pathfinder as we're wrapping up again the champions, Brian and Lori and Sawyer, their young kid that rode around because Noah Davis, who's usually with us on a way boat, was in the tournament this time. And Noah, how was your first experience of being a tournament fisherman?
It was a really fun time. I got to learn a lot. The guy I fished with, it's his first year really getting into the walleye fishing. He was a ex-bass guy. So he had a different viewpoint from things I've learned from other anglers being around on the wayboat. He was a big technology guy, and I learned a lot about that stuff this pre-fishing with him since Thursday to today.
So you guys do a lot of fishing with your family, and you've fished with Brian, and you've made some friends, Mark and Curtis, you know, both of you fish with them. How is it to be on that side of it? I know it's easy to be the young guy that is, you know, asking questions and them giving you the answers they want, but or that you want. But what about being on that side? Is it as informative and are people as nice?
There's definitely some people that are like, oh, you're fishing this one. We're not going to tell you anything. And then there's some guys like Mark and Curtis that we keep bringing up who I've made pretty close with over the past mm-hmm. couple of years who called. I was over at their camper and watched some TV with them last night, the National Water Tour show. We were watching that and they were giving me advice on what to do, and we were watching it and they'd show something, be like, they pause it and they'd be like, yeah, so this is what we are doing today. You want to make sure that when you pop it up or whatever the tip is, and then they'd be like, that's how we caught our big fish today. Or and then today me and my partner were sitting in one of our spots and they drove by and they stopped and they said, follow us, because me and my partner were having a rough day. They said, follow us, we'll show you where the fish are.
So, which that's not a normal thing. It's just something because you have made that, you know, relationship with them, and they want to see you successful in the future. So one of the other things that I think that you probably have learned is a lot of the insight from Brian and Mitch on this side of the tournament. So being on the angler side of it, I'm sure you're like, okay, well, we have to do it like this because this is how they're going to want it.
We tried a lot of different strategies. On Wednesday, we caught one on a plastic. So we were diehard plastic, big fish. And then we tried that, and then they really stopped on the plastic. Every day this week it got worse. Then we sat on that spot this weekend where we caught that big fish and just tried every single bait you can find. Like, and we had a large variety of walleye baits from my history and a large variety of different like swim baits from his bass fishing history. And between the two of us put together, it was just... It was rough to, and it kind of made me appreciate those, how good those anglers are, because I'm usually on the weigh boat and I get to see, oh man, these guys caught a big fish. Why are these guys not doing good? And today I found out why those guys are not doing good.
You can have an okay day one day and the next day it kicks you right in the pants.
Yep. That's how it went for us.
So now that you've got that out of your system, because I know you've always wanted to, like, I wish somebody would pick me to be on their team.
Right.
And now you've been there. So what's the future look like for you?
Well, I definitely, for the first two tournaments, Mitch and Brian, that's when they need their help, because we have the most amount of boats. It's kind of crazy with how the marina's treated us and what we have to do with it. So I definitely want to be there to be the guy that helps them out, since they kind of picked me up and got me into all this stuff. But especially for the championship in this tournament, when, you know, you only need two way boats on the water, and for the championship when it's a picture thing, I'd still love to fish those and some other tournaments like the Nebraska one. That'll be fun to fish with some people we've also talked to, Joe Rangel and Keith McClarney. Those are some people we talked to last year.
So, and I've asked you this before, but if a young person is listening to this, you've been doing this 4 years now, I think, right? Were you 11 or 12 when you first started?
Mm-hmm.
So what would you say to a young kid that wants to be a tournament angler and wants to really be part of this kind of a system?
Just talk to one of these guys. All of them are super nice, and we always need the help. We'll always let you ride along on the boat, and it's fun to have you. And that's kind of how I started, and I've been getting people want to fish the Masters with me next year, and the NWT, they've asked me if I want to do that with them, which are those national tournaments that are on the bigger scale, which all started by me holding boats together and saying, you got a big fish in there,
So it definitely is something you want to continue. And outside of your high school life, your lifeguard duties, your football and track and all that.
Yeah, it's definitely one of the things I'll make my priorities over all that stuff. And no matter how important some of that stuff can be, like high school, this is definitely the priority there.
At least during the summer.
I've been asked quite a few times in the past couple of weeks by just new people I meet or even my fishing partner, what do you want to be when you grow up? Well, I don't have a solid plan yet, but I want to have a Ranger, and if I don't have a house, I'll just sleep in that and drive around and fish.
Very good. All right, Noah, well, congratulations on your first tournament, and we hope to see you back on our side soon.
Yep, we will. All right, thank you.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Noah. That's going to do it for the Pathfinder Wyoming Walleye Stampede wrap-up show. The next time the Stampede is in action, it'll be for the championship at Boisen, August 8th and 9th. Stick around next week. We're back with another show on Wyoming Hooking and Hunting Outdoors.
Wyoming Hooking and Hunting Outdoors with Drew Kirby. If you have a question, want to make a comment, or have an idea for a show topic, message us on the My Country mobile app. Wyoming Hooking and Hunting Outdoors.